Hello, and welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. Just a quick note that I really appreciate how much traction LQ Radio and the podcast really specifically have gotten recently. As frequent listeners know, I usually do the podcasts on Thursdays. Last Thursday, I was unable to do the show and decided, instead of doing one over the weekend, as I sometimes do when I miss a show, to just postpone it for a week and do the next podcast today. I was somewhat surprised to get multiple emails, comments on the site, etc., asking where the podcast was. That means that you really are listening and finding value in the podcast, which I think is great. Thanks. Next LQ update. LQ ISO hits 2 million downloads. LQ ISO, which was launched just about 20 months ago now, has facilitated over 2 million Linux ISO downloads. The site currently has 342 distribution versions available from well over 600 mirrors. The site also boosts improved statistics on the homepage, some new RSS feeds, email notifications for newly released versions, and even suggests the fastest local mirror based on where you're browsing from geographically using the GeoIP information. If you're looking to download a Linux distribution, be sure to check out LQ ISO, and also be sure to suggest it to those looking for a place to quickly and easily download Linux. The URL for that is iso.linuxquestions.org. The last LQ update is LinuxQuestions.org adds Linux and open source jobs marketplace. So this is a move that's a little bit new to LQ. We've just released an LQ jobs marketplace. Basically, it allows employers to post Linux, open source, and programming related opportunities to LQ for a small one-time fee per position. Over the years, we've gotten an increasing amount of requests from companies to tap into the huge talent pool that exists at LQ. With over 250,000 registered members around the globe and countless new visitors every single day, LQ obviously has huge potential for a resource when people are looking to fill open source and Linux-related job positions. Additionally, it really is in the best interest of LQ to have as many people working as possible gainfully employed in the OSS field. So I really viewed this as a win-win. What's more, prospective employers can use a person's LQ history to get a general feel for not only knowledge, but also temperament and how they kind of carry themselves over a long history. And I think a posting history that spans, let's say, a year or 2 years or even more will likely provide more information than any resume or interview possibly could. So happy job hunting. Now on to the news. The first story I have is OpenXML Translator Project is announced. Brian Jones recently announced that Microsoft will be releasing an open document format converter for Office. The OpenXML Translator Project is hosted at SourceForge and is available under the BSD license. From Brian's post, quote, "While we still aren't seeing a strong demand for ODF support from our corporate or consumer customers, it's now a bit different with governments. We've had some governments request that we help build solutions so that they can use ODF for certain situations, so that's why we're creating the OpenXML Translator Project. I think it's going to be really beneficial to a number of folks and for a number of reasons." Continuing, there has been a push in Microsoft for better interoperability, and this is another great step in that direction. We already have the PDF and XPS support for Office 2007 users that unfortunately had to be separated out of the product and instead offered as a free download. There will be a menu item in the Office application that will point people to the downloads for XPS, PDF, and now ODF, so you'll have the ability to save to and open ODF files directly within Office, just like any other format. End quote. This, I think, should be seen as a fairly large step for Microsoft, who had strongly opposed ODF in the past for, I think, obvious reasons. We may have finally reached a time when Microsoft is no longer able to force its customers into a direction they don't want to go. What's more, they may even be realizing that interoperability is the way they'll be able to have a bright future. Now, to be sure, it's going to be a slow change, but if this is the seed finally planted, it will be looked on as a watershed moment. On a different topic, while this should be seen as good news for the consumer, it could actually end up being bad news for OpenOffice.org. Had Microsoft stood their ground and not supported ODF at all, OOO would have certainly seen rapid mass adoption in some government segments. With Microsoft promising to support ODF, whether they end up actually doing it properly or not, that's a lot less likely to happen. But that begets the question, is this just a promise? Has Microsoft really started a turnaround, or is this just an opportunity for them to claim to support ODF, make the implementation so bad and so delayed and so much of a pain that ODF looks like garbage, and people are not probably going to realize it's the implementation and not ODF itself that's at fault. At that point, Microsoft could make a large push for a new and improved OpenXML with the next Office release. So I have to say, they seem genuine on this one, but they do of course have quite a track record with these things. So our only option at this point is to wait and see, while proceeding, I think, with extreme caution. The other potential problem is that companies and government agencies have a purchasing edict that all documents must be saved in ODF format, but no real operational procedure that mandates actually using ODF as the final format. ODF is of no use if people simply continue saving documents in either OpenXML or native Microsoft formats. Could ODF become another POSIX type situation where support for it is really just something that companies list as a feature that their product has checked off, while in the real world it's not actually used in the way it was intended? The fact that save will get you OpenXML while ODF will require you to export could start to lead in this direction. Let's hope that doesn't happen. And as this case is a little different than the POSIX one, I'm optimistic that it won't happen the same way. The next story I have is eBay banned sellers from using Google Checkout. It appears that eBay has now prohibited sellers from accepting Google Checkout. From the accepted payment policy on the eBay site, quote, payment services permitted by eBay are AllPay.net, BidPay, Canadian Tire Money, Cash to India, CertiPay, Checkout Free, HyperWallet, MoneyBookers, OZ Pay, Payco, Paymate.com.au, ProPay, and Zoom. It then goes on to list the payment services not permitted by eBay. Now there's quite a few of them, so I'm not going to read them all, but suffice it to say, in the middle there is Google Checkout. It also adds, quote, as described in our safe buying guide, eBay strongly encourages sellers to offer payments through PayPal. PayPal is not only convenient to use, but it also offers buyers and sellers industry-leading protection against fraud, chargebacks, and theft of financial data. Merchants with their own merchant credit card processing account, and those who use a third-party credit card processor, may also offer their buyers the option of paying directly with a credit card online, including through third-party checkout or by phone. End quote. Now, never mind that eBay owns PayPal, or that PayPal has a long, storied history of not doing what's in the best interest of the consumer. And a little disclaimer here, LQ had a major PayPal issue a while back that was well documented at the time, and kind of due to the popularity of LQ and the exposure I was able to get, I was able to remedy the situation in the end, but I can say for certain firsthand that their customer service really was appalling, and the experience was somewhat disconcerting. Now, we do use PayPal, and to be fair, that was a little while ago, but I think it's an indicator, and if you look around on the web, the LQ story certainly is not unique. Now, that, of course, is not to say that Google Checkout won't have its own problems. We'll have to wait and see on that, but with many years of paying AdSense customers under its belt, it seems odd that Google as a company doesn't stack up favorably against companies like Payco, whom is directly tied to PayPal, by the way, or Canadian Tire Money. I can see why eBay as a company may feel threatened by the prospect of Google being able to eventually tie together Gtalk, Google Checkout, Frugal, AdSense, and Google Base. That would be a serious, serious threat to eBay's business. But you have to think that this would constitute using a monopoly in one area to unduly influence another. I think eBay could certainly be considered a near monopoly in the auction space, and they're certainly leveraging that in the payment space, it would seem to me. I'd be surprised if either something doesn't give or a lawsuit isn't filed in the very near future on this one. eBay obviously wants to take advantage of the network effect as much as it can, but I think here they may have crossed the line. The next story I have is, will Oracle offer Red Hat support? Some recent comments made by Larry Ellison have sparked speculation that Oracle may soon offer Red Hat support. From the article, quote, A claim that Ellison made repeatedly throughout the briefing was that the software giant is targeting Red Hat support, specifically providing support services for Red Hat Linux users. The reason for the move, which Oracle executives later declined to provide any real detail on, is that Red Hat isn't doing a good enough job providing the support itself, Ellison said. Red Hat is too small and does not do a very good job of supporting them, was his quote. He continued, "What Red Hat does is every time to fix a bug, you have to upgrade the operating system. They don't support old versions, but just fix bugs. That is not proper enterprise support, and I think our customers are demanding that, and I think you'll see it coming from us," end quote. It should be noted here, I think, that in RHEL, when a bug fix is made, it is backported to the existing version of the package, as opposed to, say, Fedora, which updates to the latest version that includes the bug fix. So I think what he's stating is a little bit disingenuous here. My guess is that this is maybe in retaliation to the Red Hat JBoss acquisition. Historically, Red Hat and Oracle have been very, very close partners, and in fact, early Oracle support is one of the things that really broke Red Hat into the enterprise in the first place. That relationship, though, has been on pretty shaky ground now that Red Hat is a direct competitor in the middleware space. To be sure, there are a couple of options here. Oracle could just acquire a Linux company. Now, Red Hat here seems like an unlikely choice to me, which would leave Novell as a possible primary target. They could also simply put together their own distribution. While it would probably get decent penetration in the Oracle market, I can't see it gaining too much traction in the general market. Another option would be that they could also simply provide support for Red Hat installs. For the long term, while Ellison kind of insinuates it here, there really seems like an unlikely option to me. Larry is too much of a control freak for them to just support a product that they have no real control over in the end. What I could see happening is a bit of a mix of two of the previous ones, where Oracle offers a possibly Red Hat-based clones, something along the lines of, say, CentOS, that they fully support for all Oracle installations. This would allow them to push Red Hat out of the Oracle market while not having to worry about the general Linux market, and they wouldn't have to expend that much energy to do it. Other companies have done this in the past, and Checkpoint comes to mind here with the secure platform that they had, and Oracle, of course, has the resources to make it happen. So the question becomes, would this be bad for Red Hat? I would say the answer to that is arguably no. See, Red Hat knows that they can't possibly support every Linux installation out there. What's more, though, they don't even want to. The next generation will not include a Microsoft-like monopoly, and I think Red Hat knows that. They plan to profit significantly just by being a dominant player without having to be the only player. That means anything that's good for Linux in the end is potentially good for Red Hat. More companies adopting Linux because Oracle supports their own version for all their database installs mean more people get exposed to the advantages of Linux. In the end, that means more potential sales for Red Hat. The Linux and open source model is once again being validated. The next story I have is eWeek Labs Bake Off, open source versus .NET stacks. So you could probably guess it by the title. This is yet another interesting benchmark or study that's been released. And this time, like I mentioned, it's the eWeek Labs Bake Off. The benchmark article seems to ascertain that .NET and Windows is in general ended up outperforming LAMP. The test here? Quote, "We use portals we consider popular. Microsoft SharePoint Portal Server 2003, built on ASP, oops, built in PHP, Plone, which is Python, and Liferay and JBoss Portal, which is JSP. So the problem to me with the report starts already. They are comparing products that are in no way similar. You see, SharePoint is an office-based collaboration and information sharing tool, where Zoops is an extensible, easy-to-use dynamic web content management system, and Plone, which is Zope-based, is a content management system with very strong multilingual support. As you can see, SharePoint is not really a product you'd ever use as a portal replacement for these other kinds of products. Now, aside from that huge difference, there are myriad other problems. They seem to have picked the PHP product based on the fact that it's the most popular on SourceForge for the category, but I'd not say it's an enterprise-ready product that out-of-the-box focuses on performance. So additionally, SharePoint uses MSSQL, Zoops uses MySQL, Plone uses ZODB. So to be fair, Despite the title of the article, they do start referring to it as a stack test, which is seemingly about what it's turning into. So far, so good. Except, you can't really test a stack and then base the results on completely different products meant to do completely different things. To me, it gets worse, though. Quote, "But the point was to test the stacks, not their ideal performance points, which is also why we didn't tune or optimize any of the systems, but ran them as close to the default as possible." End quote. Now, of course, in no circumstance would any company just deploy any size portal without doing any optimizations at all. For the case of Plone, not only did they not perform any optimizations, they actually installed it directly contradictory to how the manual says to install it. And what I mean by that is the manual very specifically and clearly tells you not to do something, which is put Plone directly internet facing without an Apache or Squid type proxy, and that's what they did. The PHP product is also going to get heavily penalized here, since out of the box MySQL comes with a horrific setup from a performance perspective. And on a kind of a side note here, if you're wondering why that is, it's because MySQL is installed by the majority of Linux installs with the realization that the end result is not going to be a high-end MySQL server. Because of this, the default setup is very resource-friendly, but not very performance-friendly. The end result is that they somehow managed to get two transactions per second out of the LAMP install. That number should have raised an immediate red flag. And that end result, to me, pretty much makes the study nearly useless. On the topic, though, the study could have been an interesting one, and then, in fact, I think still could be. A tuned setup comparing a Windows portal and a Linux LAMP-based portal would be interesting, but not just from a performance perspective either. Let's get one of each set up, tuned to the max and configured properly. Then, test it repeatedly over a long period of time so that the stability can also be entered into the equation. You see, lightning fast but completely unstable is of no use in the real world at all. Also, let's apply official patches over this long period as they come out and see the impact they have both on performance and stability. After all, if something's fragile and requires a lot of administrative work, that should be a point against it. Now, that would be a useful article. It would also be extremely time-consuming and costly, which I assume is why no one ever does it. The reality, though, is that until someone puts that amount of effort into a study like this, they aren't going to be very useful to anyone, and they'll be misleading to almost everyone. Now, I'm a little bit already over the time that I usually like to take, but since I didn't do one last week, I'm going to pick one last short story here. And the one I'll do is Microsoft hit with 280 million euro fine. And I covered this topic a little bit in the last podcast. So the EU has indeed followed through as promised and fined Microsoft what amounts to about 357 million US dollars. From the article, EU Competition Commissioner Nelly Kroes said she had no alternative but to levy penalty payments against Microsoft, adding that no company is above the law. And a quote from her was, I regret that more than 2 years after the decision, Microsoft has still not put an end to its illegal contact. End quote. It was also noted that a daily fine of 3 million euros could be put into force after July 31st if Microsoft doesn't comply. Of course, Microsoft does plan to appeal, according to General Counsel Brad Smith. While it's true that compared to the huge sums of cash that Microsoft has, which is billions and billions and billions of dollars, this is not a mammoth loss. But the reality is that this will have real implications on the profitability of the European market for the year. Aside from that, the repercussions to public opinion and the documentation gained by the actual settlement should not be understated. I'm sure the Samba guys are just champing at the bit to get real documentation on how things actually work. In the end, even those of us outside of the EU will benefit substantially from this. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening.